the more writers.
Can we talk about this on the podcast?
Just so you know what it is.
Okay, I understand. And I have a view on that.
Okay, hang on.
Welcome to The Writer and the Critic, a bi-monthly podcast devoted mostly to speculative fiction books, reviews, and whatever else takes our fancy. I'm your host, Kirsty McDermott. Also joining me is your co-host, Ian Mond.
Have you missed me?
No.
I was talking to the podcast.
Oh.
Because I knew you'd say no. Well, I've missed me, but I don't think anyone else has missed
No, that's it. That's not
They've
true.
Forgotten we exist.
No, we got feedback.
We did. From who?
From Chris. Chris has emailed us before, and he said, hooray, we're back. So
do you think you'll do that every 2 months?
I don't know. See, but he gave us some feedback about the last episode, obviously, when we're talking about the two anthologies, and point out that he just really liked them too and thanked us because he wouldn't have come across We See a Different Frontier if we hadn't been talking about it.
Well, there you go.
So that's lovely. So thank you again, Chris, and we hope to bring you more books that you may not know about.
Yes.
And other people. And
not just Chris.
Ian and I ourselves. I mean,
this is
not
just a recommend books to Chris service. I just want Chris to be aware that this is...
We are Chris's personal book recommendation podcast.
Yes. Anywho, I understand it's been a big 2 months since we were away.
It's been such a big 2 months.
But we're not a news podcast, so we're not going to talk about all the events.
We are not.
If you want to hear what's been going on, well, frankly, just Google. Actually, I'm not even going to say what. But there's podcasts that deal with this sort of thing. However, we might talk a little bit around those issues and the residuals of those issues. Maybe.
Well, I came across...
So as not to date the podcast, of course.
Why are you so worried about that?
About dating the podcast?
Yes.
Because I don't want to re-listen to my hour-old episodes and go, oh, yeah, that was so 2014.
Oh, my goodness me. Seriously. We don't have history. We don't have an ongoing discourse.
I want us to
we
be eternal.
We don't make artifacts that
no,
are part of the
no,
ongoing discourse.
No, I want us
discourse.
To be immortal and eternal.
How can you be immortal and eternal if you're not of your time?
In the next civilization, after the destruction of this one, I want people to have picked up our podcast somehow and go, wow, it's as if they recorded that last week.
I think that would be awful.
Really?
Yeah.
You think you need that sense of history?
I think what I really love about...
This is not the talking
culture,
point we discussed.
No, but it's interesting though because one of the things I love about, say, reading history or watching old TV shows is the sense that this is not of our time. That like it's something that's specifically grounded in the time that it's been produced in. And I think if you had something that you couldn't get a sense of the time, I think that would be sad.
Absolutely agree with you, which is really why I'm not sure where I'm coming from because I actually have the same. I do like that frisson.
Yeah,
anachronistic, not for them, but for us.
Yeah, it's really good. I mean, I guess
can we get onto the talk before I ramble on about other.
So what came up in my feeds just this morning is actually obviously a very recent piece that Jonathan McCalmont wrote
for October 24th,
and he wrote this on his Ruthless Culture blog, and it's a piece. Bouncing off, among other things, the recent article by Kathleen Hale, which was published, I know not why, by The Guardian, recounting her...
Well, you know why The Guardian published it. Because it's clickbait.
Yeah.
It's been spoken
yes,
about
Yes, I guess
by
so. I guess I don't associate
I think my
The
mum
Guardian,
knows about it.
I guess I don't associate The Guardian with
no,
that kind of
mum.
Clickbait.
Why not?
I don't know. I now do.
No, it's
but
the
not.
Question is why did she write it, not why did they publish it? Because I know why they published it.
Oh, I think it's quite clear why she wrote it. I don't think
that is clear. That's my problem with the whole article.
Well, the gist of the article is that for those of you who don't know, it's an author whose debut novel, among myriad reviews that did receive, some of which were positive, some of which weren't. Received some bad reviews by a Goodreads review.
No, it's specifically the Vine Amazon reviewers. So
it was a pre-review, pre-publication review.
It jumps to Goodreads because I think the reviewer is also on Goodreads or something, and she was having.
But in any case, to cut to the meat of the article, it's a debut author who has received a bad review by
a Vine reviewer.
And has essentially winding up stalking this reviewer to the extent that she finds out this reviewer's home address by legitimate means, but the way she she came by these legitimate means and was not genuine. And she ends up at the reviewer's house. She ends up calling this woman at work and pretending to be someone who's a fact chaser and then calling her back and saying, ha-ha, I know who you really are, stop lying. And it's this really detailed, very disturbing example of authors just taking bad reviews way too far.
Yeah, but if you were Kathleen Hale, you would take a issue with what you just said. Well, because she would argue that there's a big gap between this person wrote a review and I ended up stalking them. There's the, in the middle, there's Twitter bullying and a bunch of other things that go on that force that Kathleen Hale believes caused her to go slightly insane.
Yeah, but
and resulted in her finding out the person's address. And then what she ultimately does is justify it by saying, well, it's all just catfishing.
But the problem – well, yeah, but the using catfishing, which is a problematic term in itself, but it's misapplied in this because saying someone who's an anonymous reviewer is catfishing you is – like people can write reviews under a pseudonym.
I didn't know catfishing had become a word. I know it was a documentary.
Yeah, no,
2010
because of the documentary and the subsequent TV show, it has become kind of a word.
And there's doubt about whether, and if you listen to our Shooting the Pooh episode, you can look at this. Mm. It's not called Catfish, but we did a Shooting the Pooh episode on documentaries. There's a doubt whether it's even a true story.
I now think it's not, sadly. Having watched, this is off the point, but I'm going to mention it.
No, it's critical to this.
Having watched the TV show, which spun off from it, and I did watch a whole season of it. And,
you did?
I did.
It's meant to be awful.
It was awful, but it was – there's things I can watch while I'm exercising, and sometimes things that actually make me angry are good because I exercise harder. So out of curiosity, I did watch a season, and it was – yeah, it was not good TV, and the fact that this was – this was genuine situations. This was people
Ari.
I can't remember his last name. And contacting the host of the show and the guy who goes investigates. So they are real people with real situations in the context of the show. And it's just, it's messy and it doesn't have the dramatic arcs and it doesn't have the, it's just the mess of people's lives.
Oh, you're saying
and
the realness
perfect.
Oh, okay. So you're saying the realness of the TV show puts a bad light on
it. Now makes me think, the movie was constructed.
Well, no, I think
it's just so perfect.
And the point of catfishing.
Mm, but anyway.
Not the story that goes, because they give this lovely catfish story that goes.
Yes, yes, yes.
The point is that Ari is approached via Facebook by this woman. It starts a relationship with her.
Yes.
But she's a false person.
Yeah, and it's not just a pseudonym she's using. She has created this complete false identity.
Correct.
as someone who is in age and like everything complete. She's just created a fictional person.
But is looking for the relationship.
Yes, is looking for the relationship as a fictional person.
Correct. Now,
that's quite different.
Not what's going on.
It's quite different to a reviewer.
That's how Kathleen Hale's justified. She said, oh, it's just a catfish.
I've been catfish. It's like, no, you haven't. And also,
someone using a pseudonym does not mean catfish.
Like it ended? That whole, at the beginning, that whole, you know, the reviewers and the tweets, whatever it was, that kind of came to a natural end. And then she restarted it. By when she was asked by Goodreads, you know, who do you want to interview you, like for this book competition, she requested this person.
Yep.
This person didn't come forward and say, I want to interview. She actually reignited the whole thing. And that's how she got this reviewer's address. And then she did searches and found out what she thought might be her real name and where she worked. And at the very end of the article, she's there is a lack of self-awareness in what she says, but she's expressing gratitude that she has so hounded this critic and reviewer that they have locked their Facebook and their Twitter, and they've basically gone into lockdown because they don't want this author, Kathleen Hale, following them anymore and reading what they have to say. And she's kind of thankful for that because that has ameliorated her obsession. But she still kind of wishes that this reviewer still was live.
I ask my original question,
so
why would Kathleen Hale write this?
Yeah,
why would she think that she comes off as sympathetic in this article?
She has taken this sort of half step back from the situation and has acknowledged that, I think not acknowledged enough. I don't think she really appreciates what she's
done. She says things like rock bottom.
Exactly.
She uses those sort of
but
terms.
But it's more about her own obsession and the fact that it has chewed up her life rather than the effect it has had on this other woman.
Has she written a response to this?
I don't know. To be honest, I read that and I haven't followed.
Okay.
Anyway, so that's all to say. Well, this is the incident that Jonathan McElmont has bounced off in his essay that he's just posted on Ruthless Culture. And he goes through his reviewing career and some of the difficulties he's had from the side of being a critic and a reviewer and having certain authors and editors take umbrage at things he said and the fallout from that, and how he's discussing the structures of power between reviewers and authors, and how authors feel that, that they have no power and they're expected to just sort of sit back and take bad reviews.
Yes, they are.
And not.
Yes, they are.
And yes, they are. Yes. But.
That's the end of the discussion.
No, well, it's not the end of the discussion. I mean, you're not meant to go out and stalk your critics, obviously.
And I don't think the reviewers should be stalking the authors either.
No. But like, yeah, it cuts both ways. But there's this, and it's a really good essay, and I'll link to it in the show notes. And I think people, whether you're an author or a reviewer or both, because there are some of us who are both, it's really worth. Well, that would be one of me. I would be one of them. There are many me's. They do many things. So I think it's really worth reading and thinking about, because as with most of McElmont's work, he's very thoughtful, and the arguments he goes into, and as with a lot of his criticism of books, they're not just one or two paragraphs, I liked it, I didn't like it kind of thing. They're very thoughtful, insightful readings and then writings about.
So what does he conclude?
There's a paragraph in the middle that I would really like to, I'll just read it in full, because he's addressing. Actually, what I'll do first is I'll read an extract from Robert Jackson Bennett's blog, where Bennett is talking about these power structures and how authors are on one side. And this is a quote that McElmont puts into his essay. And so here's what Robert Jackson Bennett says. In my experience, artists aren't the powerful ones in this situation. We're vulnerable, powerless, and deliberately exposed, and it's assumed that we'll stay that way. Granted, we chose to be in this situation, we've put ourselves out there before the world, but the increased anonymity of the internet means we catch a lot more tomatoes in the face than we used to, and it's assumed we'll grin and bear it.
Yes.
And this.
Yes, it is assumed that.
And, you know, McElmont takes issue with this and does point out that what, you know, this is the, you know, that side of the argument that we're expected to grin and bear it and we shouldn't have to is where situations like what happened with Kathleen Hale and her reviewer came from. And you know, there was a lot of teardown of her article, but there was also a lot of positive response to it. Like, yay, this, like, finally an author standing up for against those horrible blogging bullies who, you know, so there was some of that about. Now, there's a paragraph, though, in the middle of McElmont's piece where he's actually talking about the changes in structure, because it's one thing, I guess.
You mean the power dynamics?
The power dynamics between authors and readers within publishing. And it's one thing to say, as we've done and we've both said in the past, and I will continue to say, you know, you don't have to respond. You don't have to have a Google alert. You can maintain a distance and not read your reviews. But I read this paragraph of Jonathan's and I thought, actually, really, maybe you can't. And let me read this, because I think it's a really important point that he's making. The reason that authors are starting to catch a lot of tomatoes in the face is that the publishing industry has royally fucked them. Step back a single generation and you will find that most of an author's PR was handled by their publishers. Sure, an author would have to do the occasional interview and maybe the odd public appearance, but when a publishing house decided your work was worth publishing, they put their weight behind it and allowed you to spend your time writing rather than hustling for PR and managing your brand. What has happened over the last 10 years is that authors have been forced to become so involved with their own PR that there is no longer any distance between them and the people discussing their work. The reason the taboo against authors responding to reviewers has been replaced with a taboo against negative reviews is that there is a world of difference between having your PR people turn a blind eye to the things being said about you in another room and being expected to sit quietly in front of a bunch of people discussing your failings. The changes in the social protocol surrounding reviewing show how the lack of distance between authors and fans has put fan spaces under pressure to conform to the requirements of the modern publishing industry. And I think
which essentially is either write a good review or don't write anything at all.
Exactly. And we've had this conversation too about whether, you know, if you don't like something, maybe just don't say anything.
Look, can I
but that's
say,
a really important point. And it's something I hadn't actually thought about, because, yes, you can't sit there and say to an author, you know, don't have a Google alert, don't read your reviews, just don't engage, when actually the part of your success as an author these days is engaging.
Yeah, I understand.
It's being on Twitter. It's being on Goodreads, not necessarily engaging in the Goodreads communities, but having the author page. And when you have the author page, you know, when you go to Goodreads and open your author page, you see the whole reviews down the side. You can't turn that off. You don't need to get email alerts about them, but they're right there. And this is part of being an author.
And along with that is that you have to protect your brand. If you're being attacked on all sides.
Well, that feeds into it. But I'm not even talking about the obligation to protect a brand. What I'm talking about and what Mackle.
But no, isn't that key to it? Because once you take that step to become closer to everything.
Yes.
If your marketers aren't protecting you, you've got to protect yourself.
Yeah, and I think what Mackelmont is pointing out is that the idea that we could have had even 10 years ago, maybe even 5 years ago, that you could divorce yourself from all of that and just concentrate on your work and pop out every now and then to put up a blog post about, hey, I've got this new book coming out, doesn't work anymore. And in fact, as Mackelmont points out, as publishers put more and more weight and as authors self-publish more and more, they are right there at the coalface. And on a human level, forget even about the idea of protecting the brand and whatever, at a human level, it is hard. If you're not allowed to not read your reviews and not see those conversations on Twitter and people are adding you to things, you can't step away because that is now part of your job. And that is really difficult. That is really difficult. And that's part of what he's pointing out. He's not at all, in fact, he's quite the other side of condoning, you know, author interaction from a sense of tearing down a bad review or sending their fans onto the reviewer or whatever. And he's definitely not condoning any of that. But this paragraph has really pointed out that there has been a structural change. And I think authors are feeling this because they're not allowed to look away. You can't look away.
Fine. Great.
Yeah, it's really
that is fine. They've now got a more – now because of the evils of the publishing industry, they've now got a far more intimate relationship with their fans. Okay, I understand that. I still don't feel sympathy for them. I just don't. In this context, I feel sympathy for authors generally because I love reading books, but not in this context.
I think you can feel sympathy for Kathleen Hale in as an author, as a debut author – coming across these bad reviews. And I can feel sympathy for that. And my sympathy for her will continue. And it's separate to condoning anything she did.
She feels sympathy because she's come across bad reviews, read them and probably felt bad.
Yes.
And you feel sympathy just as a human being.
Full stop.
Okay.
That's it.
All right.
Yes.
Yeah, okay,
because
fair.
That's hard. Everyone gets bad reviews.
Yeah,
and
I wrote short fiction many years ago and I got a bad review and I felt bad too.
And I feel sympathy for her. But that's where my sympathy ends. And that doesn't encompass any condoning or celebration or excusing of what she then did. But the point that I'm getting from Mackelmont's essay is that it's no longer good enough to say to authors who are in this situation, oh, just ignore it, don't read your reviews, cancel your Google, because they actually can't. That's no good. That's as bad as what people will say to women who get harassed on the internet. Oh, just step away.
You can't
do that. That's part of your job. It's part of your existence now. So if we have this shift in what it means to be a published author, whether that's with a publisher or even worse, self-publishing, when you really have no screen, then we need to talk about different solutions to this very human problem of coming up against these, you know, often, especially if it's a new book of yours, it will feel like a very personal attack. And we need not to say, oh, just don't look, because that doesn't work anymore. And it doesn't work
structurally. So now they look.
So the conversations we now need to have is, what do we do? Like, how do you then manage?
Who, the author or the reviewer?
The author. No, this is all about the author managing that, because it's never good. Like, there is never an excuse for an author to harass a reviewer or a critic. Even to the point of responding directly to that review on their page or even on the, you know, on their own website, because it's very easy for an author, if you're a high profile author, to send your fans after
the good old dog pile.
You know. Exactly. Need to have a conversation. I don't have the answers for this. What I'm pointing out, bouncing off Mackelmont's essay, is that these are the conversations we now need to have, because we've moved beyond the point where we can say, just don't read your reviews. We need to now have the conversations at a human level of how you manage.
So reviewers don't need to have thicker skins. The reviewers. Yes.
Reviewers.
Don't need to have thicker skins. And just accept that an author may come along and say.
No. What I'm saying is.
I understand. No, you're saying the author needs to manage.
Yes.
But you see, you're looking at just one solution. You're saying it's all about the author. Maybe actually the critic does have to take some of the responsibility here.
I don't think so, unless the criticism or the review,
because I don't believe.
Yeah, no, unless the criticism or the review was an actual personal attack.
Well, some of them are,
and some of them are, and in that case, I mean,
why?
I mean, in that case, I'm not saying like there should then be some dogpiling onto the critic. I'm saying in that case, then there is some culpability on the part of the critic, because you have actually personally, not their book, not their anything else, but you know, personally attacked another person, regardless of what the situation was in which you did it. So then some culpability, I think, does fall on you for being a dick.
See, my thing
is, if you're just writing a review and you don't like someone's book and you're addressing the book.
I agree. But listen, I think this is a I don't normally like saying this, being a regulator myself, but I think this is a self-regulating industry in that.
It is.
Authors, yes, you're right, they need to consider how they're going to manage this, because now they're far more in the pot than they were in the past.
And by necessity.
But reviewers themselves are self-regulated in the sense that if you write a "I hate you" author, you're a racist misogynist and should be boiled in a pot and die, you're often going to get blowback from other reviewers / readers. Forget the author. Reader, I've seen that. The dog pile comes from the reader / – I don't have a problem with that, because that's the dialogue, even if sometimes it's quite violent.
That is part of the discourse. And
it's when the author decides to be part of that dialogue when it just ends in a complete shit show. But why don't we just – authors need to just, I think, be more aware that unless – they've never been heard of and no one's read their book except for this one particular reviewer. And that does happen. I've seen that with self-published books. Yes. You get this one person who's read it. There's the famous one a few months ago where a guy's gone and reviewed a book and the author has literally put in about 500 posts underneath the review.
Oh, that was astonishing.
Yes.
That was astonishing.
And you know, that's probably really the only review of that book. And that's going to happen. But generally for an author like Kathleen Hale, who's a bit more mainstream, even though this is her first novel, you know, you look at Amazon. Look at Goodreads. You'll see there are people talking about it to the other reviews and saying, one star, how can you give that one star? You're an idiot. Blah, 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 blah.
I think the conversation just needs to shift.
Okay.
And we do need to talk about the tools that you need to have as someone creating cultural artifacts and putting them into the world. And we need to talk about the tools that operate on a human level to manage discourse and to understand power structures and to cope on a human level with criticism. Because, as I've said, it's no longer good enough for us to sit back and say, well, just don't read it. That
writers have not been able to cope with criticism since the Bible.
No, true. And we used to be able to say, as McCarmont points out, you know, 10 years ago, you could say, oh, the publicist handles that, the publishers handle that. I'm not required. That you could make the choice. You could choose to keep reading reviews and get upset about them and everything, but you didn't have to. Now it's an obligation on authors to be very much in the middle of their own PR
and
their own brand and to personally interact with fans. And how do you manage that personal interaction? What is the point at which you know when you need to step back? And how do you manage that for your own health and your own well-being?
And these are
the conversations we now need to be talking about, because this is a different, as McCarmont points out, this is a different structure of interaction with fans.
I agree with all that.
So,
I don't know whether my sympathy is much as high as yours, but I agree with all that. Probably because I'm a cold ass. I don't know. Should we now, anyway,
I recommend everyone reads that, because there's a lot more that he talks about in his essay, and I've just put out this one paragraph, and it is a really, really good essay, a really thoughtful, mindful essay about literary criticism and review and where he sees it has come from and declined and some of the reasons why. And yeah, he doesn't really offer solutions either, as much as point out that things are broken and they need to be fixed, and they're not going to be fixed in the same way we used to fix them. So yeah, thank you, Jonathan. I really, really enjoyed reading that.
And come back to Twitter, Jonathan. We want you back there.
We so miss you, Jonathan.
Yes, you've only been gone for about a week, but
come back unless you want to. Basically, you don't need to come back and be a dancing pony.
Yes, you do.
No,
I need dancing ponies. What do you think Twitter is?
No.
No?
No. Sorry.
I'm other people's dancing ponies.
Sure, but you want to be, so that's okay.
Okay.
If he doesn't want to be, he doesn't have to be.
Fair point.
But we do miss you, Jonathan.
Should we segue into the books? The actual books?
We should segue into the actual books. So, I think we're going to talk about the one you recommended first. So, do you want to introduce that and tell us
the
little bit about it?
The novel is Richard Bowes. Now, I apologise to Richard for mangling his surname, even though it's only about four letters. Jonathan Strahan actually told me what the
correct pronunciation.
Yes. Yeah, I forgot. Okay. Because what was happening is I was actually talking about throwing platitudes at the book to Jonathan while I was in Perth a few weeks ago, and he started getting really angry with me mispronouncing Richard's name.
He can't remember.
Yeah, I can't remember. Yeah, just
so
went through.
Can you not remember when you first encountered his name, what you thought it was?
I thought it was, yeah, it was. I was pronouncing as Bowes. I'm pretty sure
it has to be Bowes.
And I think Jonathan was saying Bowes.
Okay, so let's say Bowes.
Let's spend the next half hour thinking about this.
To Richard and Jonathan, Jonathan Strahan, no, not Jonathan Mackleman.
No, no, stop Jonathan Strahan. No, no, you'll have to accept it. Anyway, so the novel is Dust Devil on a Quiet Street. It is called a mosaic novel because it is, in fact, a collection of short stories, Richard's done more than just top and tail them to turn them into a novel. He's actually linked them quite
well. What
carefully.
I wanted to ask you, actually, is what – and this like genuine question, not being devil's advocate or stirring the pot, what is the difference between this being called a mosaic novel and it being called a fix-up?
Oh, I don't think there is a difference. I think a mosaic novel is just a nice – word for fix up.
Okay.
Nice way of saying fix up. I think if you looked at the old SF novels of the past, which were fix ups, they would be called mosaic novels now.
But often a mosaic novel is written with the purpose of being.
A fix up were previously things that have been previously published.
Yeah, which a lot of these were.
Well, I think nearly all of them were.
Okay,
yeah. Not in all of them, but anyway, where you've taken those stories, put them in a novel, and just put a bit of connecting tissue between them. That's a fix-up. This is essentially a fix-up. It's a fucking good fix-up, though. And I think he says it to you at the beginning that this is a bunch of collected short stories. In some sense, I wish he hadn't, because I don't think you. I mean, would you have noticed?
Well, I didn't read a foreword because I actually read this as an ebook, so it did that thing that ebooks do where it opens at page one.
Okay, yeah.
So I didn't actually read any forewords. I did go back and then read his.
Did you feel that it was a bunch of vignettes?
I felt quite. Yes, no, actually, from after the end of the first, it was very clear within two or three movements, I guess, that this was. This is short stories that have been strung together.
Okay.
I'm not saying that that's a bad thing. I'm just saying that was quite clear.
See, I even knowing it, I thought he did a brilliant job.
I think he did a great job, but it was very clear that and as you went through the book, that I think that lessened, or maybe you got used to the transitions, or maybe it was that the sheer fact that he kept pulling material from previous things into new stories, so it did feel...
Well, for one, they're not published. The stories aren't in the order that they were published.
No.
So it keeps coming back to characters and situations.
Mm-hmm. So do you want to just give a very quick overview?
Okay. The novel, and I'm going to call it a novel.
Yeah, it is a novel. It's absolutely presented as a novel.
Set in New York. It's set at pre and post 9/11, so just before... Well, it starts pre-post 9/11.
Yes.
But actually the novel is about Richard's... growing up.
The narrators.
No. It's Richard. I think it's clearly Richard. We're going to have this discussion, aren't we?
Yes, the narrator, the unnamed narrator.
All right. Fine. The unnamed narrator's life in New York as a young man.
See, I hope you're not really thinking Richard Bowes came across a copy of the Necronomicon in Interlibrary Loan.
Well, no. But I do think that Richard is good friends with Chris...
Yes.
Barzak and Ellen Datlow.
Yes, but this is an unnamed narrator.
Who happens to be friends with Ellen Datlow. And wrote books that Rick Bowes wrote.
Unnamed books.
Bowes. No, they're not unnamed.
It's the book about the thing and the book about
the thing. No. He describes the plot of some of his actual books.
Doesn't title them, though.
Oh.
This is important.
Anyway, I think you're getting a feeling with the sort of book this is. It's set in New York. It moves around in time because the focus of it is about his relationship with another young gay man. And a woman, their names actually are different in this book than they are in the short fiction that he published.
Mm-hmm.
And the implication is that these are their real names, although they're actually just fictional characters, as I get it, as I understand it. Although, again, you don't really know, do you?
No.
It's that, stop, why are you acting all like you know the,
because I love these
coy,
kind of books.
You're doing that whole coy, mysterious thing.
I love
as if,
these kind of
I
books.
I really know what's going
no,
on.
No, I don't. I don't. And that's what I love about
so,
it.
So, yes. So, setting. If it sounds like I'm struggling to describe it, it's because it doesn't sit still as a book.
Yeah. It's a memoir of sorts.
It's a memoir,
A fictionalised memoir.
It's all about New York.
Mm-hmm.
It's very much about the post-grieving from 9/11. It's very much coming to terms with sexuality, with identity, with memory. It's very much about a relationship that he had with people in his past who have died, and remembering them. And it's also a fantasy novel in amongst all that somehow.
And no, it's very much a fantasy novel. Well, this New York is replete with magic.
Yes.
And supernatural
What's
things.
What's astonishing about this book is that it all feels so natural. Because it's not. This is not an urban fantasy novel. This isn't unnamed.
Well, it is. Okay. It's a fantasy novel.
So I mean urban fantasy in the Jim Butcher sense. It's not Rick Bowes, unnamed narrator goes off to kill werewolves, although there are werewolves in this.
Yes.
And there's Lovecraft. A Lovecraft story in this.
And ghosts,
correct.
Metaphorical vampires.
Yes, no, there's vampires, yep. Mm. So it actually has all those elements.
It does. But it's an urban fantasy.
Yeah, it is one of the – it's a deconstructed urban fantasy as a memoir. There you go. I should have said that.
It's awesome.
A deconstructed urban fantasy as a memoir.
Is that like when you go to one of those fancy restaurants, you get the deconstructed cheesecake and you get a bit of biscuit crumb and a scoop of cream and some fruit.
That's exactly what this is. Because fuck me if the Lovecraft section isn't the spookiest thing you've ever read. About the guy who finds this –
book. Yes.
It's fucking creepy.
Actually, the creepy one for me was the library one.
The guy who commits suicide,
yeah,
that's jumping off the
pattern in the library, which is Lovecraftian as well, the idea of the patterns. And
yep.
I think that was beautifully written, that section. I think the whole thing was beautifully written. And I really liked the shifty nature of it. And I was – even though I cottoned on fairly early that this was a – there was a lot of, I guess, biography threaded through this book.
But did he actually have friends, those two friends? Because their names are different, as I said, because there's a few excerpts of this online, and I check those excerpts. And it's interesting to see how he's changed the stories. And their names, and when those characters are mentioned, their names are different. One of the clues is anyone who's got a surname in this novel is probably not real.
Yeah, it's probably.
Did you notice that? Characters, because
I actually didn't notice that there were.
There's such a blurring going on that I had to go and find if any of these people actually exist. Now, I know Chris Barzak is, but he doesn't get a surname.
Okay.
I just knew it was Chris because I know Richard's friends with him.
Yep.
And there were enough clues. Ellen is just called Ellen.
Mm-hmm.
But it's an editor for, doing anthologies who commissioned stories from me. Who else is it going to be? And I think KGB is mentioned as well, which we know Ellen does readings at.
See, that's really interesting because
pick any of that stuff up?
I didn't feel any need to go away and try to verify
the existence of these people.
Yeah. I was really happy to be reading this as I said, I got the feeling that there was more biography than you would otherwise find in a work of fiction. And there was that lovely melding of what was real and who was real and what's been created. And it's not necessarily everything that isn't fantastical or supernatural is real, definitely not. And possibly not even that everything that is supernatural and fantastical is fictional. So
this is not a book where you're meant to doubt the unnamed narrator's sanity,
No.
I mean, there are werewolves in this book.
Yeah, this is a book about memory. And, yeah, it is set in a fantastical version of New York with a version of Richard Bowes. And I loved sitting within this book, and what I found quite astonishing about it is that it's the narrator is positioned pretty much throughout as this peripheral character. He's on the edge of things all the time. Like he's always described the stories he's describing. He's not at the center of these stories. He's the outsider, the onlooker.
He's not an unknown narrator. I've just gone and done a Kindle check. I'm sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt.
Yes. So he's Richard in the book?
Yes.
Okay. But yeah.
Does that just completely
No, it doesn't. Because it's obviously a fictionalized memoir. But yeah, is he Richard Bowes in the book though?
No, I couldn't.
There we go.
Oh, okay.
To
be fair, he's only mentioned a couple of times as Richard.
Yeah, I miss those references. But, it's not I'm Richard Bowes, here's my memoir, is what I'm saying, right? It's this book that utilises memoir and uses a lot of the techniques of memoir. So this shifting back and forth, because memoir is not biography, when biography is written, it's often written in a linear way. Even if it's autobiography, it's written in a often
is that the difference? Is that the actual difference?
No, it's not the difference. Biography is meant to be a much more complete.
Rigid? Oh, okay.
Complete sense of a life.
Yep.
And often contextualized within whatever theme the biography is taken, whereas memoir is always written by the person with the memories,
yeah.
Whereas biography can be auto or written by third person,
yep.
But memoir can be a memoir about one particular event of significance that's happened. It can be a memoir on a theme. A memoir around a collection of events or times that this person is putting together and finding significance in. And it doesn't have to be exhaustive, and it doesn't have to be, you know, linear or come to some great arc of a life. And often memoir does consider and play with these concepts of memory and how memory works and how a person can they ever remember accurately? And what does it mean to witness something? And how can the idea of witnessing and memory work together and be reliable?
And that's what
if they ever can be reliable.
The fantastical elements are play with that.
Well, I think in this book you have to take the fantastical elements insofar as we don't know, because there's the theme of ghosts that run through the book.
Well,
and we don't know whether some of the characters are ghosts or not. But
I should contextualise that. 9/11 has opened a crack.
A hole in the world.
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah.
And ghosts have come through.
That's right. And we don't know whether some characters are ghosts or not, but that ambiguity doesn't threaten the notion that there are ghosts. It's just we don't know whether that character was one.
Well, yeah, but there's also the metaphor as well of 9/11 being such a destructive event in American history.
How you then read these fantastical elements. But within the book itself, as you said, there's no suggestion that this guy's just mad and he's seeing things.
No. You meant to read it both ways. You meant to read it not mad, but you meant to read it as are ghosts.
That's exactly.
But also, there's that secondary reading of this is a metaphor for what 9/11 means,
as it's an American. A lot of the best speculative fiction does
that. Well, not a lot of speculative fiction.
No, the best speculative fiction does that.
Increasingly finding very rarely does. That whole myth of. Sorry to drag Star Trek in, but that whole myth of how Star Trek was really just an allegory for stuff that was going on in the 60s, it's not a myth, it's true. It was. And maybe science fiction of the 60s was like that, but science fiction today is less and less and less of an allegory of what's going on in the wider world. Fantasy definitely is, especially epic fantasy is completely – that's what's so refreshing about this.
Okay.
Because it is so much that.
Sure, but are you entangling the idea of fiction being – fantastical fiction, speculative fiction being self-consciously allegorical, which – I would agree with you, most of it isn't and shouldn't be. And reading.
Why not?
Because why should it be? Allegory is a very powerful tool, but it's not the only tool. And
okay.
It doesn't work for every. In fact, it wouldn't work for almost all the stories that are being told.
Okay.
But there's a difference between speculative fiction being self-consciously allegorical and your reading of the genre as a whole as being something that you are able to employ allegorical tools to and allegorical reading to. So it's what I say a lot. One of the great strengths that speculative fiction has, whatever genre it's working in, one of the great strengths of non-realist fiction as a whole is the ability to talk about very important, very complicated, often very emotional things at a distance.
Yeah, but you just said at its best. Does this? It does exactly what you just described.
Yeah, the best of speculative fiction admits.
And I'm saying there's fuck all of that. That 95% of it doesn't even try to do that. And you're
but
right.
It's not. It's not that it's self-conscious about it. It's just that it admits this reading.
Yeah, but you've put an aesthetic. You've put you've made it subjective. You said at its best.
Okay. Sure. The stuff I like.
Yeah, okay, thank you. That's what I was leading to.
Yeah.
Okay, gotcha.
But no, I do think this is one of the most powerful tools of the genre, and I do think that, okay, some of the best works are, if not self-consciously positioning themselves within that allegorical context, they're admitting those readings, and they're what the authors are thinking about. the authors aren't thinking about actual ghosts in New York. The authors are thinking about what these concepts mean, what they map to in the world.
Yep, okay.
But, you know, also to be a really good work of speculative fiction, you can't let too much of that self-conscious allegory show. It has to be its own world. It has to make sense within itself.
Yes.
Otherwise you get something like Snowpiercer, which is a fun movie, but it only works as allegory. It doesn't make sense in its own world. It's only allegory.
Well, no, you just don't know the
engineering principles. No, it doesn't. It makes no sense.
You don't know the engineering principles behind it.
It's not even about the engineering principles of the train. It's about how human beings work.
Okay.
it's a wonderful allegory. It's like Animal Farm. Wonderful allegory. Really good. Really pointed. Love it. We don't get enough Marxist movies. Want more of them. But it only works as allegory.
The left-wing agenda of this podcast is disturbing. But okay.
Well, just we get so much other.
And what Dust Devil on a Quiet Street does so well is it melds the allegory plus the fantastical.
And it integrates its world.
And tells a story.
Yes, that's it.
This is not just a bunch of metaphoric wink-wink, nudge-nudge, the sort of shit that can annoy sometimes.
Yeah, there's no coyness about it.
Correct. The Lovecraftian element. I keep coming back to that because it really left an impression. The Lovecraft story or the section in this book is Lovecraft. It's squamous. It may be using that word.
It's Eldritch.
It is Lovecraft. It's a beautiful – and you can see Richard and I'm – he's still alive, thank God, and can probably comment on this. But I can just see him sitting in the library, which probably was his full-time job, so I think that's probably real.
I don't know.
Notice how I'm qualifying everything we would probably.
But
I'm going to go for a crack and say
I have
that
no knowledge and had no
that he did work as a librarian or you know in a university. I'm going to just
maybe
go for the
okay.
Crack.
Yep.
I could have probably checked his life story online, but didn't bother because you know while we research for the podcast, you could just see him sitting there thinking, you know what, this place just screams Lovecraft. I'm doing a Lovecraft story, and that's exactly what he's done, and it's scary.
It is scary. Look,
the book is more than just that.
I found this book. I'll have to say, it did take me maybe a third to get to pick up the rhythms of the book.
Really? Because the 9/11 story that it starts with is astonishing.
Oh, no. Like, I really like that. But, I mean, in terms of what the book's doing and its cyclical nature of
what coming back to
the characters and the themes and all of that, that really picks up in the last two-thirds of the book and really powerfully. And when I say picks up, I'm not talking about pacing. It's just that because it takes a while. You to draw threads in, you have to have some place from where to draw the threads.
Yep.
So, you know, the first two or three stories are laying the groundwork from which threads will be drawn.
Which might be about his
works.
Friendships, which might be about his therapy,
that's
which
right.
might be about his time in the library.
Yeah.
Yeah, okay, I got you.
But can I read you the line that I think is my favourite line in the entire book? And I highlight it. I love it so much because I forget who said it, but a writer said it years and years. I heard it at uni when I was in undergrad. And it was something about to the effect of that every novel is written to hide one line. And the idea is that there's one line that a writer's thought of when I want to use that and I'm going to write the, and yeah, or conversely that there is this is one line that the book can kind of be drilled down to. And, this may or may not be that line, but it's the one that I love, and I think it acts as a motif of the whole book. And it's in the it's right bang almost around the middle of it, actually. And it says, "Writing is the place where I can be as bold and compassionate and wise as I choose."
Oh.
I think that's beautiful, and that's because, you know, the narrator of this book is a writer. So he's talking in this book about actual writing short stories and all of that stuff. So that line is referring to both the narrator of this book and why he writes fiction. But it's also referring to Richard Bowes, the real author, and this book that he's written, which is about him sorting through memory and sorting through experience and people and being able to reflect and being able to have at, you know, because this the character is an older man, you know, he's only his 30s.
Yeah, it's a book of reflection.
40s. I mean, it is someone in the last third of their life reflecting on the first two thirds and
absolutely.
On the people and being more compassionate than maybe they would have been at the time, or being bolder in what they assert or think or draw conclusions from than maybe they would have been at the time things were happening. And it's sort of this whole, yeah, it's almost a manifesto. It's a manifesto of this type of storytelling.
I think that's a beautiful point. I don't really want to derail it, but I do have to.
Yes, sorry. No. Well, that's the end of my point.
So. Well, but I'm going to derail it. Look, I should have just read his about the author, which is at the back of the book.
Oh, you didn't read that?
I probably did, but I read this book a few months ago.
Where he's talking about the Dust Devil conversation?
No. That's the foreword.
Oh, that's because I went back and read the foreword after.
About the author says he wrote fashion copy, just like the character in this book, and plays. Just like the character in this book, sold antique toys in flea markets. Is there a story about him selling antique toys in flea markets?
I don't think he did that, but there are flea markets and toys. Or maybe like he does the character design board games.
Yeah, he does. Yes, correct. Yep. And worked on library information desks and got into an amazing amount of trouble along the way. So he did work on library information desks. And if he's listening to the podcast, which I believe he may be, he'll probably be yelling at us from 10 minutes ago saying, I did do that. Whether he did it at the same library
for that length of time.
Yeah.
And this is what we don't know. And I guess when you're
looking, it's not that hard to find out.
But do you want to?
No. Well, yes, I did. No, see, look. There is a part of me, and I might, maybe because I'm reading quite a bit of historical fiction because it's being nominated on book award lists and I'm just happening to be reading it, that, for example, I read the Richard Flanagan's novel, the Booker, and that's about the Burma Railway. I've just read Anthony Dawes' nominated National Book Award shortlist book about the World War II and France. I've read a whole bunch of books.
Historical fictions. Yeah.
And this feels a bit like historical fiction because, it is. It talks about riots that actually happened in New York. It
talks about the Stonewall riots.
Yeah, the Stonewall. I mean, this is – so I couldn't help but thinking that the characters around are also real. And so for me, unlike you, just as happy to be absorbed in the world that's being created, even if that world is partly real, I couldn't help myself. There's an itch. I had to bloody well – and with a Kindle, it's much easier. You can just highlight their names and go to – and what Google
and
just –
search them.
Yeah, and when you know it's – you know they're not real when Google – the only response that Google comes up with is this book. when Wikipedia is not the first thing. Yeah.
Yeah,
but that doesn't mean it's a bad book. It just means I had an itch to scratch.
Yeah, exactly. And I think that depends on the type of reader you are. And I don't think that's a wrong way to read. I don't think there is a wrong way to read a book like this. And there have been other books where I've wanted to know. Like other books like this that are playing with fiction and reality, and I have wanted to know whether this particular thing really happened or so on. But in this book I didn't, and I can only explain it by saying that it didn't feel like the kind of book that was playing with reality in that way. It wasn't a book like House of Leaves, for example, that was playing with reality in a sense of this actually happened, this is real, this is documented. This book wasn't doing that. This book was using the tools of memoir, and for that I'm more than happy to go
along.
You're right.
It's in House of Leaves.
It wasn't
very much
challenging me to say, is this real or is this not real? Yeah. It didn't matter. The whole thing could be fiction, and it still would have had the feeling of memoir and autobiography.
Yeah, you're
enfolded right. in with it, and whether you know 50% of it is real or 10% or 90% or none of it or all of it. That has an effect how I've read this book, because it is so beautifully crafted, borrowing tools from speculative fiction, from memoir, from poetry, all of this sort of stuff, from the art world, and just giving you this beautiful immersive experience. And it really was immersive. And there was like so much of the reading. One of the things I loved about it, and I really loved about this book, was it's talking about memory, and it's talking about how you piece memory together and how you have – like there's involuntary memories. Something will happen and wow, this other thing. And reading this book was like that, because you're reading it and a character will turn up and it's like, oh, hang on, I think they're from
– Yes, you know, yeah,
the
you're
reading
right.
of this book was the experience
of reliving
of
memory. Yeah,
of
you're
remembering.
Right. And that's how smart it's been constructed.
Yeah, it's so good. You know, and when I said at the beginning I could –
Because
I could feel from early on that it was short stories that had been put together. I didn't mean to say it felt clumsy or anything like that. I could just see where the discrete narrative has risen out of.
Yeah, and it reflects real life, how people pop in and out of your life. They pop in and out of these stories.
Yeah. It also wouldn't have surprised me to go to the copyright pages I did when I finished it and to find that it was all completely original to the book, and this was just the way it is written. Like it wouldn't have surprised me that much. Yeah. I would have gone, oh, okay, this is the way he wrote it, because this is what we do with our lives. We make stories of our lives. We when we're telling something, someone about something that's happened, or when we're thinking about something, we craft this little narrative, which is this story which pops up in our life, and it's this discrete story, and we leave out bits which aren't necessary that happened at the same time, but they're not relevant to the story. We're very good at innately creating narrative, most of us. We know where to begin and end a story. We know what is relevant and what isn't when we're telling someone an anecdote or something that's happened to us. So this is how we remember things. We remember things because we make them make stories out of them.
And yeah, this story really just ends. It abruptly says, yep, this is about the right spot to end the story, and then puts a full stop on it.
Because borrowing the tool of memoir, yeah, this is where he is at the moment. This is the sense he's made of his life so far. These are the threads that he's picked up and drawn together, and this is it's an exercise in sense making.
Can I just say, I have to thank the World Fantasy Award judges, because I'm just going to make a huge assumption here and say that this is not one of the popular vote books on that ballot.
I would probably go with you with that. I would be so delighted to be told I'm wrong.
Yeah, okay.
I would love for this to have been a popular ballot book.
So there are 6 books on the ballot. This is one of them. Mm. That won't be announced for a few days. I don't know if this podcast will be out before or after.
I'm going to try and get it up.
Because I've read all 6 books. Mm. So I can speak now with some authority. In a good world, in a proper world, in a world essentially run by me, where my tastes are dominant, this would win the World Fantasy Award.
So it is your favourite book on the ballot?
Yeah. Samatar's Stranger in a Laundrette is a very good book.
Mm-hmm.
But this is head and shoulders above it. Just because, you know, what I said before, it being a deconstruction of an urban fantasy, even though I just came up with that for this podcast, it's just so different and interesting and refreshing and not trying to give us the same old messages and do, I don't know, it's just so, it's innovative. In a way that, even though you're saying you're right, it's using tools of memoir.
But it's using them in an innovative, I mean,
And it's a mosaic novel. All the things it is are things that have been done before.
Yeah.
But the way it's doing them are innovative.
And I don't – now that I'm – have since I've turned 40, I'm no longer so enamored with the novel and the new and, you know, because we do retell our stories and we do reread our stories and we do build upon what's happened. And, you know, the novel and the new is always important, but it's not the be-all and end-all. And to say someone is using tools from this and tools from that doesn't mean that they, A, haven't created an original work, which they have, because no one's written this book before.
Yeah.
No one's going to write this book again.
No.
This is a book unique to Richard Bowes. It has to be, right? It is an original work. He's not just copying and pasting what someone else has done.
Well, he actually probably did a lot of copying and pasting
on his own work,
actual book.
Yeah.
But you know what I mean? Yeah.
I mean, we can't just value the novel and the new and the quote unquote original because everything builds on something else.
It's also the most literary book on that ballot, and in fact, it is a very literary.
I don't think I've read any of the other books.
So on the ballot, I'm doing this off the top of my head. First off, pat on the back for doing this because I am.
Oh wait, is Hild on the ballot?
No.
Okay.
No, it's not.
Okay.
So we've got this: Sophie Samatar's *Stranger in a Laundrette*, Neil Gaiman's *The Ocean at the End of the Lane*. I think it's called.
Yep.
Gene Wolfe's *The Land Across*.
Mm-hmm.
The Golem and the Ginny by Helene Wecker.
Yep.
And the Marie Brennan, the Memoirs of Lady Trent Dragon book.
And this one. Okay, no, I haven't read any of them.
Okay, so I've read all 6.
Yep.
Look, I'm not going to go and review each of these books because...
Yep. This is your favourite.
But easily.
Yeah. Okay.
It is the most literary, and it could easily appear on a literary type ballot,
it got shortlanded for the Lambda Awards.
Yeah, it did. I'm so happy for that the World Fantasy judges have done this is, and Richard, don't take offence, but this is the sort of book that gets forgotten.
Well, I would never have read this book.
I would never read it either.
I'd heard his name because he has. I've got, like, I own like stories of, it. have popped up in anthologies. I don't actually own, and from looking at the biography on his website, this is how he puts his novels together for the most. There are collections of stories that his
later stuff,
and some of his books are collections. They're just straight out collections of short stories. But yeah,
both Minions of the Moon and From the Files of the Time Rangers are collections. But then there were a couple of earlier
that were standalone.
Correct.
Okay, but I'd be very interested in looking at those two other Mosaic style novels, because I think his writing is beautiful, and I think it's quite—it's quite a skill as a writer to be able to not only, you know, write about the concerns you're talking about and to the theme and construct the world and everything, whether that's a fantasy world or the real world that you're reconstructing, all of that, but to actually mimic the experience of what you're doing in the reader. I think is remarkable.
But this is why shortlists and ballots.
Yeah.
To get back to the point.
Yeah. Okay. This is why shortlists and ballots, because they bring attention to things
I'm sorry for being patronising.
Yeah.
Something I don't ever do on this podcast.
No,
because they do bring light to books that you would never have heard of or missed.
And I'm really like, thank you so much for recommending it, because I am actually, and I don't say this about every book that I like because there are limited time in the world, but I am going to find his other two books. Maybe not for 2 or 3 years after I finish my PhD. But I'm genuinely interested in reading.
But what
more
you're
of
trying to say is he'll get royalties out of you.
But yeah,
and it comes out of Lethe Press.
It does.
And again, it's not a publisher I read much.
They do some really interesting.
They
work.
Do, but I can't put my hand on my heart and say that I support all their work.
Okay.
No, I'm just being honest. There's too much out there.
Oh, in terms of you don't, yeah. Not that you object.
What, object to gay, lesbian fiction?
You just said I can't support all their work. It sounded odd. It's like I object to some of their catalogue.
I'm not.
You mean you don't necessarily read or buy all their work?
Yeah, yes. It's the sort.
You don't financially support.
Just like Aqueduct, and they're the sort of small press publisher. Yes. That I would love to read everything, but time is of the essence.
Time in the world. You can't read everything, but what you can do is tell people about the stuff that you have read and like that they might not otherwise come across.
Oh, my God, we should do a podcast about that.
As you've done with this book.
Yes, and so thank you, World Fantasy Award judges. And, look, I hope it does win, but I think Neil Gaiman will take it. So.
You know what's interesting? We haven't actually talked much about the book in terms of plot and spoilers.
It's
interesting.
Because, as you said, it's a memoir and things pop in, pop out. There is a through line
sense. We could absolutely have spoiled things about this book. But, yeah, I think what's more interesting in this one is the stuff we've talked about.
No, but there's a thematic through line.
There is.
There's a character through line.
Yep,
but there's no
absolutely.
He needs to do something and he does it by the end of the novel. There's no
because
dramatic.
Because he's this peripheral character again.
Well, that's right.
Which I think is a really interesting way because –
Well,
because
it's very rare to have a passive character where you actually still like the book.
It's very rare to have a character who is for most of the book, and he certainly regards himself – and I think there might even be a line in there about periphery – and being on the periphery all the time. And yet, if you think about the character and you think about how other people in the story he's telling would picture him, they certainly wouldn't see him as a peripheral character.
No,
so there's a lot of thought about how you see yourself, how you place yourself. And he is, as he says, for much of his life, the narrator is gay or perhaps bisexual. And he's grown up hiding that side of himself for quite a while because he's an older man now, so it certainly wasn't...
Well, he definitely hid it in Boston.
That's what I mean. It wasn't something he could say from being a teenager or so on. So there's a lot of that. So this character has felt a peripheral character, a character who's kind of been on the outside, who can't put himself forward all the way because there's a part he always has to hold back. And perhaps that lingers even when he is out, even when people know he's gay and he has relationships with men. And it's still like if you've been trained in a way or trained yourself to always keep a part of yourself back, to have an element of reserve, maybe you can never really, you know, if that's your formative years, if that's how you've wired yourself socially and functionally and mentally, maybe you can never really get that. And maybe you carry with you all the time this sense that you're not quite
and
participating fully.
Right. And the impression
which
I get
really
is
sad.
The impression I get is that he would have wished to be something different because, in terms of his writing especially.
There's the whole metaphor about the witch boy and the human boy.
Yes.
I think it is really
sad.
Well,
that's one of those things that runs through the novel.
Yeah.
But just this idea that going from what you've said, that he could have been a more populist novelist and made more money out of his writing, and if he'd been more
other paths that could engaged. Have been
traveled. But he's a writer yeah, and he loves to write.
But here's the thing:
I'm seeing him as Richard. But what struck me, rather than
whereas I'm talking about the character, but what struck me is, I guess, that the character and possibly Richard Bowes himself. But even in a work like this, I hesitate to draw too many connections between a character and an author.
Oh, I think you can in this book.
I don't know what I'm playing with. So,
well,
but anyway,
that's the game.
But what I'm saying is, I feel that if you talk to the people in this book, they would have stories where Richard is the central character. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like, so you have this character who feels himself always on the outside, always on the periphery, always the onlooker, always the one.
Even
who's
a Lovecraftian story, he's not the central character. Yeah. It's someone else.
And yet, if you did ask these other people, they would have stories about Richard,
yeah,
where he's the focus of the story.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah, that's kind of this balance of perception and how you see yourself.
He's a catalyst for other things that occur. Look, you're right, and it's very hard to pull that sort of thing off, to have what is essentially a bitty novel, because there isn't really a plot that runs through it.
There's not a huge thing.
Well, there is. I mean, 9/11, I suppose, but that's also thematic.
It's contextualized.
Yeah, that's right. It's not a plot.
No, it's just the context.
It's a bitty novel because of the way it's written. It's got a passive protagonist. Mm-hmm. All these, you know, wonderful jargonistic terms, and it works amazingly.
It's beautiful because I think the voice of the novel and the mode of the novel.
It's a very human voice.
Because actually, okay, it's because you talk about a passive character, and I would agree with you in the sense of how the character portrays himself as physically interacting with the world. But, you know, he does take the initiative on several occasions to do things. You know, he does find the book and go, oh, he doesn't just shut the door and walk away. I mean, he does things. They're small things.
Yeah, he's a catalyst.
They're not huge things. They are small things. But also, he's a very active protagonist in the sense of how he's actively sifting through his life and his memory and constructing
things. That's
very
meta-Kirsten.
But you know what I mean? Yeah, so we put the emphasis on he's not physically doing so much, therefore he's passive. And yet, as this narrating character, he is not passively walking through this story.
Yeah, but you're essentially saying the choices that have been made, the story choices in a sense, are an active.
Like he's not passively sitting back and just going through his life. He's actively choosing to deconstruct his life and to find meaning in it. And that is a very active thing he's doing. It's just not physically active.
That's brilliant.
So it's a bias. It's a you know, we put a lot more weight on stuff that, as we can see with a lot of this stuff that's happened in the last 2 months online, we put so much more weight on stuff that happens physically, and that's somehow more important and better or more harmful than stuff that happens within our heads, within our psychology, within our virtual lives perhaps. And it's possibly a bias that we need to look at really dismantling because, physically, he's a passive character. Psychologically, he's an extremely active character. He's making this book. He's actively sifting through memory and deciding what is or isn't real, what might be imagined, what conclusions he may have drawn that might be wrong. It's a very active way of constructing your life.
I love it when I choose a good book.
It's a great book.
Because that is what you've just done there is just – that's what you don't have to say anymore. That's brilliant.
Okay, we shall end there. So if you are listening, Richard, thank you. It's a lovely book. I really enjoyed reading it.
Yes, thank you very much. I've actually already thanked him.
Yeah, you did earlier.
Yeah. Well, no, not just on this podcast. I've thanked him personally.
Oh.
Yeah. No, he's
so you as a critic reached straight out to the author. You crossed that divide.
I friended him on Facebook. He didn't have to accept the friendship. He could have said, I don't know who you are. You couldn't go and get fucked. Well, maybe not that.
Yeah.
But he didn't have to accept the friendship.
No, I'm just saying, like, we need to renegotiate these boundaries.
All right.
Anyway.
Highly recommended. A book that's probably nearly impossible to spoil, so you should be able to go into it. Anyway, next book. This is your recommendation. However, I'd already read it and said many joyous things about it.
I did not know you'd already read it.
Don't you read my website?
I
know only 35 people actually read it. I thought you were one of them.
Sometimes.
The reviews are too long, aren't they?
I don't. Well, actually, you know what? I probably kind of knew you'd read it but had forgotten because I wouldn't have read the review because, as you know, I don't actually read reviews of books. I mean, definitely intending to read. And I knew I wanted to read this book. So if I'd seen that on your thing, I just would have flipped through it and not not Reddit. Okay, so this is We Are All Completely Beside Ourselves, which is Karen Jo Fowler's latest
book. Can I stop you there? Just want to say one thing.
Okay.
For Christ's sakes, people, read this fucking book, then listen, okay?
I was about to say that. You totally stole my thunder.
But you weren't going to do as stridently as me.
I was, okay.
The bows, I can be shrill. You're impossible to spoil. This book, we can spoil it in 2 seconds.
It's really interesting. Okay, so as We Are All Completely Beside Ourselves, the most recent book by Karen Jo Fowler, which was shortlisted for the Man Booker. Didn't win, sadly. I haven't read The Flanagan, so I don't know. But
no, The Flanagan's a great
book. So much.
This is better, though, but The Flanagan is a very good book.
Now, as Ian said, I am going to say again with underscore and double underscore, if you have not read this book and you have not already heard the key, and you'll know what it is if you have heard it, the key element that is left unknown on the hardcover version, because I will say the paperback copy tells you.
Bullshit.
Yep. And the American cover of the hardcover gives it away too.
The cover?
Yep. We'll get to that in a second. So if you've not read the book and you're intending to and you haven't heard the thing, as with Justine Labalestier's Liar, I would urge you to and I'll be sad to lose you. Sorry, but you need to go now and read this book and then come back. And I'll put the time code, as I always do, so you can get straight to this point of the podcast and hear what we have to say about it. But honestly, this is one of the books I feel so strongly about that you should not know the thing that happens about a third of the way through.
Yes.
On a first reading.
Should we have a moment of silence?
We should have a moment of silence. Do you think they're gone?
I think we've got now 6 listeners. But anyway, we're back.
Okay. So for those of you who don't...
Fern is a chimpanzee. Well, fuck them. If they're still around after all that.
I'm going to leave that in there.
No, seriously, if they are still listening.
This is a book about...
Fern, who's a chimpanzee. No, okay, keep going, please.
Okay, this is a book about two sisters and it's told, narrated explicitly as a narrated story. I can't remember whether it's explicitly said that she's writing a book. I don't think she is. But this is a story that Rosemary, one of the twin sisters, is telling you. This is not just you're in her head listening to, you know, she's telling you this story.
Yep.
And she's very deliberately structuring the story in certain ways.
Yep.
For very good reasons. And so, when it first came out, like at base, it was at least some of the editions – we're talking about like it's about two sisters and one sister's not there anymore and there's this mystery about why that sister's not there and how the family is dealing with this. And on later editions, there's a chimpanzee on the cover. And as I said,
the
paperback version explicitly says the flat copy does give away.
I know it's about 90 pages through, but
it's 77.
It's 70. Okay, so it's not.
Yeah.
Even,
oh, look, there's
it's
the cover
a quarter
there.
Of the way through.
See, there's one of the covers for the chimpanzee. The cover I bought the UK hardcover, and it's lovely. Actually, it's a tree, and there is a girl swinging from the tree, a clearly human silhouette swinging from the tree, as children do.
It hints that's a.
There is another edition of this cover that is American cover, which is a yellow cover, and the figure swinging from the tree is very clearly a chimpanzee. So, yeah.
Do you think there's a whole story behind these covers and what Karen Jo Fowler thought?
I know what Karen Jo Fowler thought. I did a workshop with her at the Brisbane Writers Festival.
Oh, really?
Yes, I did.
And what did she say?
She's a bit sad that at least the first go round, some people gave away, like some covers gave away the book.
I don't have a problem with reviewers giving it away because, frankly, that's their job. But
and you can't talk about this book without it. You can't.
No.
You have nothing to say if you didn't talk about this. But for the book itself, too. I mean, I can read you the flap copy on my edition, which does not give away. And the flap copy is basically, you can't choose your family, but they can make choices for you. Huge life-altering choices. As a child, Rosemary never stopped talking. So why, now that she's a young woman at college, doesn't she talk very much at all? She used to have a sister, Fern, the same age as her, and an older brother, Lowell. She loved both fiercely, but they have vanished from her life for reasons she can't face and no one could guess. She may be quiet in person, but on paper she's still as exuberant as she was in childhood. So here is Rosemary's story, utterly captivating. It's funny, clever, and swirls with ideas that will come back to bite you. And I think that's a really, really clever
I didn't know Fern was a chimpanzee. No. I thought Fern was a dead sister.
So you didn't know. You didn't know.
No,
you weren't spoiled.
I had absolutely no idea. I thought Fern was a dead sister. Even though the book tells either. You, the book actually says she's not dead.
Yeah.
But I thought, no, she's got to be dead or something.
I knew there was something amiss with Fern. I wondered if she had an intellectual and or physical disability of some kind, or had she been kidnapped. I didn't know, but you knew there was something that you weren't being told, and despite the fact that in retrospect it now seems ridiculously obvious that the book starts with a quote from Kafka's story, which is narrated by an ape.
Yeah.
I hadn't made that connection. The fact, like, I knew there was something wrong. There was something wrong with Fern too, because yeah. People had made comments to Rosemary as a child about her sister. So I thought that there was something.
But Fern could have been gone to a mental asylum.
Yeah, but that's what I mean. Like, I thought there's something about this child. Yeah, but I was going towards medical condition because there were only five when this happened. So I thought it can't have been something that Fern did. Like, it wasn't they were separated at 15 because Fern killed someone and got sent to prison or something, right? So, but I didn't know. And I didn't really care. It wasn't something that really, like, I wasn't turning over the page just waiting to find out what this thing with Fern was about, because the story is so beautifully written and Rosemary's voice is so engaging. I mean, as that flap copy said, she's smart, she's caustic at times, she's funny. It's very self-aware because this book is being written. So the book starts, it's good actually. There's a line she says her father used to tell her because she was so talkative and would never shut up. So whenever she started a story, he would say, "Don't start in the middle, skip the beginning, start in the middle." And that's in the preface. And this is very clearly flagging how this story is being told. So it's being told by Rosemary, who's in her 40s now,
yep,
looking back over her life. And it begins when she's 22 years old and at college. And then, so there's that part of it. And then the main part of the book is flipping between when she's 22, which becomes kind of the front story, and when she was five with Fern, which is the backstory. And it's framed by her in her 40s with what she now wants to do and why she's telling you her story. So that's the structure of the book. And her voice was, it like really, it was so engaging, and it had the self-awareness to it that comes from the fact that she's not 22 telling the story. I think it would have rang very false to me.
Yep.
If it didn't have the outer frame of a woman who's in her 40s.
Yeah, that's right.
As with Richard Bowe's book, there is a distance, a separation, an opportunity
to genuinely
self-reflect.
Yeah, yeah.
And to put, because again, it's a book also, it's funny how these things just, we have this synchronicity, Ian, because again, it's a book about, you know, to a great extent about memory.
It's all about memory.
And what you remember and how you can decide what is true and isn't true, and
this is very much about unpacking memory and
exactly.
Dealing with the
and how do you cope when you have a memory that contradicts someone else's memory of the same event? Yes. How do you,
because in this case it's her brother that she's,
yeah,
you know, the brother doesn't appear until
but also there are conflicts of memory
with
her
mother
and
as well,
father.
Yes, and that's actually critical towards the end.
Yeah,
yeah.
And so it is a book that's very much about that. That's certainly one of
you're
the themes
right. So
of the book.
So how do you unpack your memory,
how
deal
you
with the grief that
real?
May come with that memory, but then find that actually people saw it in a completely
yeah.
different way, which either might increase the grief or reduce it, depending
yeah.
on.
Yeah, how do you yeah. know what's real? You know, it's really difficult because it's your memory. You feel as though you saw what happened.
Yeah.
You know what happened. You were there. And it's really hard when evidence comes up that contradicts what you know you remembered. And I've had this happen to me. And it just floors you. And it makes you doubt everything you remember about anything,
yep.
which is a good thing. I think that's something we need to always keep in mind. But we do. We really do privilege the idea of the eyewitness. And we don't unpack a lot of what it means to witness and to remember.
Hey, we can have more CCTV out there if you want.
I'm not saying that. So yeah, this is part of the themes of the book. It's about Rosemary trying to reconstruct 15 years,
which is
more than 15
which is
years
why it's
later.
Structured that way, but which is why someone like Dan Hartland, who reviewed this and didn't attack my review but said essentially I was wrong. No, he didn't say that. Sort of he did. Says that it feels a little bit too clever for its own good, and therefore it's very hard to feel sympathy towards characters such as the parents, because it all feels like it's been laid out as a set of data points. And I'm going to reveal this bit to you now,
yep,
because it's important to, you know, to the story. But actually, and I apologize, Dan, if I'm putting words in your mouth, but actually, we don't get the, because of that, we don't get the opportunity to feel the sympathy from the get-go. And actually, he's right, because I was angry with the parents. Yeah. I was furious with the parents. Yes. And it's only
but
when...
But Rosemary's furious with them.
No, but I was furious not for the reasons that Rosemary necessarily was. I was furious as a parent.
Yeah.
Not as a child of a parent. I was furious as, how the fuck can you do that to your kids? How can you bring a chimpanzee into the house?
But they didn't bring a chimpanzee into the house. They brought another daughter. And I think that's the really important thing.
It's a chimpanzee.
Thing. No, but that's the important thing. And that's the other part of this book.
Yes, that's the data point. Yes, I get that. No, I do get that.
And this is why Rosemary opens talking about her sister and her relationship with her sister and how she felt about her sister, but not telling you her sister's a
chimpanzee. But you also wouldn't send – I mean, this is where it all falls down for me.
But people did.
And I'm talking about Karen Joy Fowler.
People did, though.
No, listen. I know they did. And I'm not attacking Karen Joy Fowler's book here because it's an astonishing book. But this is where the whole – this is our daughter falls down, because when the shit hits the fan – And the whole thing rests on this idea of whether Fern acted maliciously or whether actually was provoked by a very young Margaret.
And also,
Rosemary,
let's also say when we're talking about Fern and Rosemary acting maliciously, and because what happens is Fern may or may not, depending on Rosemary's memory, but Rosemary certainly remembers it. She didn't lie. Killed a kitten.
Yes.
So Fern killed a kitten, and whether or not Fern did it out of malice or whatever, because Fern is a chimpanzee and our theories of mind only extend so far. We don't know what it is to be in a chimpanzee.
So taking all that into account, you're calling this your daughter, but you wouldn't send your daughter to a laboratory.
No.
So at some point, she's not the daughter anymore. The button is flicked, is the switch flicked, and it's back to being a chimpanzee.
Yep.
Don't get me wrong. That's actually the point of the novel.
Yes,
that's exactly
that's the
what
point
Fowler
of the novel.
Is.
What lines we draw.
Yes, exactly. That is, and so I'm not saying, oh my God, that's a plot hole. I'm saying that is actually the point of the novel. But that's why I was angry, because you can't have. And this is if my child does something god awful bad, and I don't even think what, I wouldn't suddenly think. Look, some parents would, but I personally would say it's still my child.
Yep.
And I wouldn't just flick a switch and go, well, fuck yeah.
No.
And I don't think the parents actually did. For them, it was a very hard choice. I mean, that I think when the mother starts talking about it, it becomes clear. But still, and the point
Heartland. And that it wasn't just this incident.
But the point Heartland is making is that it's very hard to feel Heartland
the reviewer,
in his review. Sorry, I've gone in a weird way.
I'm back now. Sorry.
The point he's making is that it's very hard to feel sympathy for them in particular, but others, because of the way the book reveals it makes its revelations.
But I do feel sympathy for them. Like I do. I think
it all rests on that bit with the mother and how much – see, for me, that blew me away. When she starts talking about, well, we chose the chimp – it gives the reasoning behind why they did what they did.
Yeah.
And I say in my review on my blog, that just blew my socks off. I think it had less of an impact on Dan Heartland. And I think – in terms of those characters, it really does rest on how you take that scene.
And I think – Fern is not a metaphor in this circumstance.
No, she is a chimp,
and this is very much about where we draw the line between human and animal. What we consider to be a person.
Yes,
there's a beautiful line in there that talks about personhood. That I think, and the word she uses is sieves. What is our construction of personhood that would sieve out a dolphin but admit a corporation?
Yep.
You know, and it's this wonderful, and it's full of little lines like that, which, and Fowler isn't answering most of the questions she asks, because she acknowledges, and Rosemary acknowledges, these are hard questions, some of them. They're really difficult. You know, there's no pat answer to them. They're questions we need to, right now, deal with.
The cynic in me says we don't have to deal with them. See, the cynic in me says, if you don't bring the chimpanzee into your house or do these sort of
it's
experiments on them.
Than that.
No, but
because these studies.
That act provokes those questions.
No, okay, sure. But if you don't bring the chimpanzees into your home,
you don't have to worry about, you know, where do I blur the line between
when do you experiment on animals on
Well, them? Yes, okay.
How do we take care of the animals that we raise as food sources?
And it's pat to
how
say
how do we exploit animals?
And it's pat to just say I'm anti all
what
animal
can and can't people
no,
do with their
right.
pets? This is what she's doing is she's not saying should we have these cross species fostering. Of course we shouldn't. It was a really bad idea that was done on several occasions throughout the 20th century. And it was a bad idea.
For good intentions.
Epistemologically, it was a bad idea in terms of methodology. You know, if you want to look at how chimps communicate, putting them with humans tells you nothing about how chimps communicate. It tells you nothing about how humans communicate. It was bad. It was bad science. But it becomes this very extraordinary, very intimate example of this bigger philosophical problem about how we interact with animals, how we define personhood, how we define the rights of beings on this planet who aren't human to live on this planet and be themselves. And it encompasses so much bigger than what use of primate studies in this situation. It's just bringing that in to a realistic, because as we've said, I mean, these things happen, and they all have sad endings.
Well, there's a section where Rosemary details.
Yeah, I mean,
I actually checked, the itch, I checked a bunch of those, yeah. And yes, they did.
I remember looking at these things as an undergrad when I was doing education, and I mean, there's such, there's no happy endings for any of them. There's no happy endings for any animals which are used for human experimentation.
But I just wonder what the end game was for the parents. Did they actually think that Fern was just going to be with them?
Maybe
forever?
They did. Certainly other researchers did. The Tamerlans, when they had Lucy, thought they would have Lucy.
But not how naive do you have to be?
Well, you have to remember that these were scientists who were acting under the premise that chimpanzees could be raised human. This was the premise. You could raise them to be human, to understand language, to be socialised as human.
I'm being rude.
You know, it's
okay.
A different premise.
But it is still a hypothesis, though.
It is.
Okay, so a hypothesis.
Of course
that
it is.
You're now
this, is why you're doing experiments, to test the hypothesis.
When you do a risk assessment of something like this.
Well, I don't think they knew about ethics back then.
Well, when were the Tamerlans?
The Tamerlans were in the 30s, I want to say. I might be wrong about that.
Okay.
And I'm joking about the ethics, by the way. That was a quip, and I don't mean it.
Yes, you do.
But different ethics. Ethics we've developed upon since in regards to some of the studies.
This is obviously more – this story, I think it's the 80s when they
– Yeah, she's transposed the chimps to the 70s or 80s, yeah. I want to say.
But then you would have done a risk assessment. And the downside of this not working out is – fucked. I mean, for your kid, let alone the Fern.
But, you know, but the point
Look
is...
Look at Rosemary. What, I mean, she ain't coming yeah, out, not,
yes,
you know.
Yes, but what Fowler is doing But what Fowler's doing with this is using this as an instance based on things that actually happened and not deviating too far from that to talk about the greater problems of how we see ourselves, how we see other beings on the planet. And, yeah, Fowler isn't offering a solution. She's not. I mean, there's a line where Rosemary says she doesn't want to have to choose between human babies suffering from a medical condition that animal research may have helped.
Yep.
Or chimpanzee babies being tortured.
Yep.
She wants – and there's a beautiful line where she says she wants science to save her from that choice, not give it to her.
Yeah.
It is – And these are huge questions, and I think the book, in the way that it is structured and the way that it presents, because Rosemary is a fantastic character, and she is a character who, having been brought up to the age of 5 with a chimpanzee with no intervention, because the idea was that they were twinned and this was a twin study, so there was no telling Rosemary the child that she was different to Fern. You know, they were treated exactly the same. So Rosemary has grown up with some trays of chimpanzees, like lots of physical touching, ways of moving in the world. She talks about the idea of the uncanny valley and how Rosemary, as a human, doesn't quite move the way humans move, doesn't quite act the way humans act, and therefore everyone is kind of a bit
standoffish.
Something is not quite right about Rosemary. So she's spent much of her teenage years and early adulthood pretending to be human, and she calls herself a monkey girl, which was actually the insult that the kids in kindergarten called her. So it's – and she's internalized that, and that's what she thinks of herself as. But, yeah, it's it's really beautifully written. It's so quick to read. I can't believe how I couldn't stop. This is my favorite book of the year, I think. I could not stop reading it. Like, I just wanted to get back to this book. I wanted to get back to Rosemary. I wanted to hear more of her story. And not so much from the suspense point of view, which is I wanted to hear more of her story.
So you don't
her
believe,
story
though,
was so engaging.
It's a clinical...
I think I don't.
Because it is structured in a particular way.
Every book is structured in a
particular way.
No, that's not a facetious comment. Every book is structured in a particular way. You have to look at whether there's, you know, what are the reasons behind doing that. Now, Rosemary's been brought up by scientists, by animal behaviorists and psychologists, and she's very science oriented. She's very much about questioning the evidence, finding the evidence, questioning the evidence, putting down. You know, trying to avoid bias, all of this sort of stuff.
Yep.
And and she's explicit about why she has withheld certain information because it would give you a bias as a reader where she didn't want there to be one. And not just in the case of Fern being a chimpanzee or not, but with other things. So, and if that's clinical, then that's fine. I don't think that's a bad thing though. I think Rosemary is clinical. Rosemary is being, in her 40s, very clinical about the events of her life and why. And in her 40s, her goal is to actually to rescue Fern
so
and the other chimpanzees.
So let me just quote from Dan's review.
Oh, okay, yep.
Lowell might preach, but Fowler doesn't. In that refusal to give up the parents' psychology until the last, however, the novel's governing motif routinely keeps us always at one remove from the action, denying not just empathy, but even that more distanced sympathy. We observe, but we only understand at the junctures and in the ways which the novel's its experiment allows.
I think that's right, but I think it's really – see, I don't know. I mean, I don't think I've come across that review.
You will now because you're going
to
link to it.
I'll find it. Link to it. Yeah. But I think if you can't as a human being, and maybe the past 2 months online have shown us that it's one of our great failings, if you can't reverse engineer sympathy – like, do you need sympathy for the parents from the beginning? Can you not reverse engineer that? Can you not, having seen another side of the story, suddenly go, I get that.
Yeah.
You know, I don't like the idea that we somehow have to know everything from the get-go and once we've made a stance against someone, there's no way we can change our mind. I'm really uncomfortable with that. I think... Yeah, I didn't like the parents most of the way through, and I thought the father was awful. But that was very much from my standpoint of, you know, knowing about these types of animal experiments anyway. So I was coming with prior knowledge, and once Fern was a chimpanzee, it was like, oh, that's what they're doing. They're some of those people.
But wait, one of the critical things we're not told, and we're only told until the mother says it, is that Fern herself was in a bad state.
Yeah.
They ultimately chose Fern. Because Fern had been hurt or tortured, I don't know what, but she was not in a great state. And when you realise that actually it's not just about experimentation, but there's also love and care and dignity involved,
based
on the parents' choice. They're not,
sure.
This is not some cynical choice here of, pick any chimpanzee.
But Rosemary's told you that. Rosemary's been very clear that her and Fern were treated the same.
No,
and in fact, there's even a
not the Fern. No, you're not told until the mother says that the choice of Fern was because Fern was in a bad shape.
Why they chose?
Yes, why the parents chose Fern?
Well, they chose Fern. They didn't choose Fern.
No, let me.
The mother said
I'll
the mother said she didn't want to take a chimpanzee from its mother. So when this chimpanzee came up. Yeah, I know what it says. But I'm saying, like, when this chimpanzee was presented as, hey, we've got this orphan chimpanzee who's going to die, okay, we'll take that one. It wasn't, you know what I mean? They wanted a chimpanzee, but she was adamant that she would not.
No, you said, they just took that one. She says.
Yeah.
Okay, yes, you've said all the bit about the diarrhea. Well, she was covered in diarrhea. She was streaked with diarrhea, covered in fleas. She wasn't going to live, okay?
Yeah.
Still, that was the week she took hold of my heart. She was so little and so alone in the world, so frightened and sad, and so much like a baby, so much like you, only with a lot of suffering added. I told you, Dad, I didn't see how the two of you could be compared when your world had been so gentle and hers so cruel, but here was no turning back by then. I was deeply in love with you both.
But that's after she's gotten Fern. It's not like they went somewhere and picked from a whole bunch of chimpanzee babies. You know what I mean? Like the structure was she's willing to do this experiment, but she's not going to take she's not going to do it with a chimpanzee baby that's been taken from its mother. So if they can't find a chimpanzee that's been orphaned, she won't have any part of it because she doesn't want to take a chimpanzee from its mother. But it's not like she chose Fern. And then, of course, once they've got Fern, she falls in love with her. But I got that. I got that from Rosemary's story. I didn't get it firsthand from her mother, but I got that in the way.
No, see, I didn't get it from Rosemary's story.
See, I did. I got that in the way she was talking about how – and there's this passage where she's talking about, again, kind of reflective of Richard Beau's menage a trois constructions, where she's talking about how, you know, Lowell was Fern's favourite, she was her dad's favourite, Fern was her mother's favourite.
Yeah.
Yeah, Fern was her mother's favourite.
Yeah, yeah. No,
of the two girls and the boy.
I understand.
Fern
I understand.
Was her mother's favourite.
But I think one of the things that Rosemary makes – I think makes clear is that there was a distinct lack of empathy, love, and emotion in this family, in this house.
It was a but for everyone.
Yeah, but for everyone. Yeah,
but
so,
not one of those. So because it was a very sign.
No. But that's my point. So you've got. Yeah. It seems like you've got parents who aren't in touch with their emotions. You don't know Fern's a chimpanzee at this point. So she maybe just a dysfunctional family. Okay, I can accept that. Now Fern's a chimpanzee.
Yeah.
So you parents who don't even know how to love and have empathy. Are bringing this chimpanzee. What the fuck is that? Only to find out from the mother that actually, no, we weren't as dysfunctional as Rosemary may have made out that we were.
I think that's
why my sympathies changed.
I think there's a difference between families who are comfortable with articulating their love and affection.
I
and families
that. No,
who.
No, no. That's a revisionist view because Rosemary doesn't write it that way to begin with. She doesn't want to talk to her parents.
I know,
she
because she's really angry about what happened with Fern.
But because she can't empathise with they can't empathise with her. The father literally cannot empathise with her. So you get this view of these are just fucked up scientists who brought – and I'm sorry if my voice is breaking. I've got this cough. But fucked up scientists who brought this chimpanzee into their house and didn't have the capacity, didn't have the tools, the basic emotional human tools to deal with it from the get-go.
But then how do you explain how once Fern is removed – the mother practically has a nervous breakdown.
I don't know.
The father turns into an alcoholic.
Rosemary, I don't think
this is a huge fracture in the life.
Rosemary doesn't clearly, in my view, until we
No, Rosemary doesn't. But I read behind that. I could see the mechanics.
I was reading the book.
Well,
see, I
and this is the point. See, and
we don't know what the event is. So it could be
the event
was so terrible. So
and it is terrible. It is awful.
Yeah, that's what did it to them. But
if they didn't care.
But.
It wouldn't have mattered. If it was just a chimpanzee they're giving away, it wouldn't have mattered.
Oh, no. But
you know what I mean?
I'm not saying – I never thought they were soulless. I just thought they were not in touch with their emotions.
I think that – yes, and I would agree with that. And that's why the father becomes an alcoholic. That's why the mother becomes so passive and withdrawn and as I said, practically – or it does actually have a nervous breakdown. Is there a suicide attempt or at least an intimation that one was?
Remember.
I can't remember. And that's because they're not in touch
I
with their emotions.
Cynical,
but that
cynical,
doesn't
cynical,
mean
cynical,
they don't
cynical,
have emotions.
I read them as cynical scientists who then something fucked up goes on. They reflect and they go, oh, shit, we might have done wrong. Depressed. Now, that's not what it is. It's genuine love for science, so not cynical at all, you know.
Yep.
Maybe not that self-aware, naive maybe. And then love. And then fucking shit happens, depressed, because of the shit that happens.
Yeah.
That's really the arc. But Rosemary doesn't give you that.
No.
Because she can't deal with it. You read behind, fine. I didn't.
Because I could read. And Rosemary says at certain, 40-year-old Rosemary, says it at various points. And yeah, it's not emphasized. It's not incredibly explicit. But she says at various points in the narrative, this is what I was thinking at the time. This is what. And if you take a step out from the book, it's this beautiful construction that, because you've got Rosemary, and again we can't and it is hard to forget because the voice, 22-year-old Rosemary, we don't get her voice. It's not hers. The whole book is 40-year-old Rosemary. The whole book is 40-year-old Rosemary.
Yeah, I accept that.
Right.
Yeah.
And so what she's doing is she's telling her she left this information about Fern to, as I said, it's page 77. Because I went back and looked it up to see how far it went in. Yeah. And she left that because she wanted you to see Fern as just a sister, as 5-year-old Rosemary and Lowell and the parents saw Fern. That's what she wanted you to see. She didn't want to say on page one, I had a chimpanzee for a sister, because you bring in all these preconceptions. Now, stay with me. I have a point.
All right.
Okay. So that's one that's one thing she's done with Fern. Similarly, what she's doing is she wants you to understand how Rosemary was when she was 22 and dealing with all this. And Rosemary was angry at her parents, and Rosemary didn't know any of the stuff you just talked about. Accept. And so she wants you to know that. So she doesn't want to say up front, oh, my parents actually, my mum really loved Fern and she did that. She doesn't want to say any of that, because she wants you to be as you were with Fern before you knew she was a chimpanzee. She wanted you to be with 22-year-old Rosemary as Rosemary was at 22.
I don't disagree with any of that.
And so that's why none of this – and then at the end,
but,
she
– But you're smart, Kirsten, are looking beyond that and saying, oh, there's more – I feel more empathy towards these parents than 22-year-old Rosemary was ever capable of.
Yeah.
With what Dan is saying, I'm taking the data point as presented and accepting that. Unlike him, though, I get to the critical point with the mum, I then review the whole.
And that's it, and that's what you can do. And as I said, I would hope I don't know. I don't know if that's what that reviewer is talking about, but I object very strenuously to the idea, as I said, that we are incapable of reverse engineering.
Well, he doesn't say reverse sympathy. He doesn't say that.
No, but like he would like to feel sympathy from them from the get-go, aren't you? But I love the idea, and I think she's done it with the book. She did it with you. She did it with me, even though I was sort of like – I was feeling that there's another – it wasn't though that I was sitting there going, but the mum must really love her and blah, 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 blah. But I was sitting there going, there's another side to this story I'm not being given.
He concludes like this. Dan concludes like this. He says, in one sense then, I'm saying that we are all completely beside ourselves is a completely imagined and faithfully executed book. It is consistent and clever, intelligent and incisive. I'm also saying, however – that is perhaps a little too much so that it seems to this reader at least to lack life. So it's too clever for its own good.
I don't think it is. I think it's incredibly compassionate. And I think, as I said, what she's doing is she's wanting to give you 22-year-old Rosemary as much as she wanted to give you Fern before you find out that Fern's a chimpanzee. She wants to give you 22-year-old Rosemary before Rosemary finds out this other stuff, before Rosemary has the scope and the distance and the extra time to think this over.
Yeah, okay, and I think I'll just want to quote one more because I've nearly quoted the entire review, but this is about when the mother reveals why they chose Fern. Yep. He says, that gives it a bit more weight, and he says, that's fine, and it certainly adds much needed weight to the parent's story, but that the novel treats all its reveals, all its episodes in this way as data points that the investigation of reading the novel must reveal and rearrange is one reason that, for me, all of its actors felt, ho-ho, like rats in a cage. That's thematically appropriate, of course, but it didn't help me feel.
Well, that's,
now I actually agree with that on one level, but then I was retrospectively able to put. He doesn't seem to have done that retrospective thing.
And that's his reading of the book.
Yeah,
and my reading is that I could always see, partially because the Rosemary who's writing the book, not Rosemary at 22, who's the subject of most of the book, is telling me that this is my memory. This is my interpretation of things, and so there's always the other side is always there. It's not being told what it is, but it's always there.
Okay, well,
and as I said, I think the way the book can in the reader provoke this same journey that Rosemary had. You don't like the parents, you're angry with them, how could they do this? And then you find out, as Rosemary did when she finally got the journals back and read them and talked to her mother. That's what you're doing as a reader. Like, in the same way that Richard Bowes was replicating this experience of memory and memoir and putting your life together and involuntary memory, Fowler is recreating Rosemary's journey for you.
Yep.
You don't get an inside track on this. You're there with Rosemary. And then, like Rosemary, you have to think about what you've thought and recontextualize.
I absolutely agree with you on that.
I think both these books do. They do the thing that good fiction should do. They put you in the story at the time the characters are. You're not standing outside of it going, wink, wink, we know what this is really about.
Yes, that's key.
And
the
journey you take with both books is the journey that those characters are taking.
Yep,
and I think it's not easy to do, and I think both these authors do it astonishingly well.
Yes. Now, on that note,
we haven't even got to really talk about a lot of the animal stuff. But, so, as I said, I think this is – there's still a couple months left of the year, but at the moment this is my absolute favourite book of the year. I love it so much. And I really enjoyed rereading it too. Because
I should note that it was nominated, for reasons I can't entirely understand, on the Nebula novel list, because it's not speculative fiction at all.
But it's funny that you should say that, actually, because what I was doing when I was looking for reviews after I'd read the book, I couldn't really find many that were on science fiction or speculative fiction websites, but there was one on IO9, and it's written by Annalie Newitz, who's she's actually,
no, she does a lot of reviews there. She's very good.
And I'm going to read her last sentence because it addresses that very thing you talked about with the nebula. She says, though this novel doesn't fit with the traditional definition of science fiction, it grapples with the implications of science in a way that few SF novels ever do. It also questions humanness by offering us a non-human perspective. Troubling, thoughtful, and gorgeous, we are all completely beside ourselves, will change the way you look at your fellow animals. You may not be happy with what you see, but you love the way Fowler invites you to do
that
it.
That is very thin.
And the idea that,
I love that
no,
line,
but the idea... Because what is science fiction meant to do? Oh. It's meant to talk about our humanity, right? It's meant to talk about science.
Literature
and how we
talks about our humanity.
No, but this is... science fiction is meant to talk about our humanity in the face of science and how we interact with science no, and what we do. And this is what... This book is addressing science experiments.
Thin. It's a whole other discussion, and we're not going to have it now, okay. But thin.
All right, put that one aside.
In fact, I dare say we'll have this discussion when we discuss your recommended book for next. For
okay. My recommended book for next month, I'm breaking my own rule a little in that I haven't read it, but I'm 99% sure I'll love it, and it's been sitting on my to-be-read shelf for way too long, and if I don't make this my recommended book, it will probably sit there for another year or two. So I'm recommending Hild by Nicola Griffith.
Just out in paperback as well.
Which is just out in paperback too, if you're reading along. So I haven't read it. Almost certain I'm going to love it. So I'm not too afraid of breaking the read the book first to make sure you like it rule. So that's my recommendation for next month. Hild by Nicola Griffith. And Ian, what are you
I'm going to recommend my favourite genre novel of 2014 so far. Not that I've read that many. Which is the National Book Award nominated Station 11 by Emily St. John Mandel. I'll probably have a review up of that on my blog reasonably soon because I've just finished it. So
that's
literally
spoilers.
Well, yeah, I'm recommending it, so obviously I like it. I love it, actually.
Oh, good.
So Emily St. John Mandel's Station 11.
Okay, so they're the two books for the next episode, which will be in December. And I will get it up before the end of the year anyway, with Christmas and stuff. I don't know when we'll actually get to record.
Could be a Christmas episode.
But it will be up by the end of the
or
year.
A Hanukkah episode.
So you guys have 2 months to read Hild and Station 11. Okay, so that will be for the December episode. As usual, please send feedback. We love to hear your feedback. You can comment at the website, writerandcritic.podbean.com. Email us to writerandcritic@gmail.com, and I'll try to remember to forward those emails to Ian because you seem to be getting
them. No, I'll see what's going on.
You can follow us on Twitter, which is @writerandcritic, and you mostly get Ian there. And don't forget to leave us a rating on iTunes.
You mostly get Ian there. It sounds like a threat.
No, well, you do. I kind of duck into...
We do say this every time.
Not everybody has listened to every podcast. I'm welcoming new listeners and not making them feel like outsiders.
You're welcoming new listeners in the last 30 seconds of the podcast.
Well, if they've listened, I don't want them to make them feel like outsiders by saying, odd, you know how
I'm
to
just
send
saying,
us feedback.
Chronologically speaking, it's an odd moment to say hello to new listeners.
No, it's not an explicit welcome. It's just saying, if you're a new listener and you're listening to this podcast for the first time, it would be really awful to get to the end and hear someone say, okay, leave us feedback. You know how.
What people didn't see is a little hand motion you just did then. That was just
But that would be
priceless.
Awful because if you're new, you don't know how, and then you're made to feel like you're an outsider.
We really need to come up with a proper ending to this podcast.
I like these endings.
Do you? Is anyone else? I'm gone. I'm done.
Goodbye. See you in December.
Bye.
Bye. Welcome to The Writer and the Critic, a bi-monthly podcast. Sorry.
The cough cast. It's the cough cast.
It is absolutely the cough cast.